This is Laura Waterman, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading science fiction. We start today with a story from the March 1987 issue of the Magazine of Fantasy and Fiction. This is The Interpreter by James White. When he was told to turn off the mountain highway and onto a narrow dirt road leading down into a wooded valley, Colgan slowed the car to a crawl, but it was not the rutted and uneven surface that was making him overly cautious. It was simply that, as he stared intently at everything around him, he was no longer in such a big hurry to get to where they were going. The trees and undergrowth and occasional wildflowers, which were lit almost theatrically by the intense orange spotlight of the setting sun, made him wonder why everything looked so sharp and three-dimensional and so extraordinarily beautiful. Perhaps this was how the French aristocrats had viewed the world on their way to the guillotine. The man seated beside him had been giving directions in a clipped but not unpleasant voice. His name was Warrender, and his impeccably casual civilian wear could not conceal a high but indeterminate military rank. Now he was communicating non-verbally by radiating extreme impatience. Colgan's family in the rear seat was being unnaturally quiet too, so that it was Warrender who spoke first. Diplomatically, he said, "Oh, we haven't far to go, sir, but if we shouldn't arrive until after dark, the clearing has been nightfall ringed with floodlights." Coogan increased speed, but not sufficiently to worry his wife. They had driven about half a mile deeper into the valley when Warrender said, "No offense attended, Professor Colgan, but I'm afraid I've never heard of your work. Linguistics isn't in my mind, naturally, but I can't help wondering why you, in particular, were chosen for this operation, and why you brought your..." He broke off as a sudden scream of complaint came from the rear seat, where young John, obviously bored with the silence and inactivity, had grabbed his three-year-old big sister's hair in his strong, stubby fingers and was trying to make Catherine's blonde pigtail come off. Anne detached the fingers expertly. She had lots of practice at it in recent months, and distributed two brightly wrapped pieces of candy from the store, reserved for such emergencies, while John began the difficult but, to him, engrossing task of removing his wrapping. Catherine held her candy tightly in one fist while her mother told her about the squirrels and deer and bears, small, friendly bears like her teddy at home, which she might be able to see if she watched carefully. She stopped crying. "It's the wrong area for..." began Warrender, then obviously decided that peace and quiet were more desirable than zoological accuracy. He went on. "I've kids of my own, you know, but I wouldn't want to take them with me on a jaunt like this. Still, you are the man they picked, Professor, and I expect you know what you're doing." "They didn't pick him," said Anne, trying to unhide the anxiety in her voice. "He jumped up and down and demanded that they send him. Besides, he's done this kind of thing before." Warrender swung around in his seat to look at her, eyebrows expressing utter disbelief. "His problem," she added, "is that he can't remember what exactly it was that he did." "Dear," said Colgan, "if you can't say something reassuring..." "I'll say nothing at all," said Anne. She forced a laugh, then returned her attention to the children. It was too dark under the trees for Catherine to see even imaginary bears, and so she had reopened diplomatic relations with her baby brother. She was doing most of the talking, naturally, and it transpired that her purpose was both simple and selfish. The track became more and more uneven as they descended to the floor of the valley, and the trees clustered so thickly around them that the sky was lost to view for minutes at a time. Colgan switched on his headlights, which revealed a road surface torn up by the recent passage of heavy tracked vehicles. Twice, he saw the shadowy outlines of tanks pulled up under the trees, their hatches closed and no lights showing. He was glad that all of his daughter's attention was engaged in conning her brother out of his big purple one. From experience, Catherine had learned that the candy given to her brother, although somewhat squashed by his vain attempts to unwrap it, was slightly larger and had a much more interesting center than the long, cylindrical, silver and red wrapped one she had been given. She was enunciating her words slowly and condescendingly in the manner of an intelligent 3-year-old trying to make a stupid baby brother see sense, while at the same time showing off her vocabulary to the grown-ups present as she pointed out the advantages of her candy over that of John's. The wrapping had nicer colors, she insisted. She could twist it into a bracelet for him, and he could wear it on his wrist, and the candy was hard and chewy and would stay nice and sticky for a long time. While she was speaking, John made enthusiastic noises, ending with several seconds of gibberish spoken in a very serious tone. "What did he say?" asked Anne. "He said, okay," Catherine replied, "but he wants me to take the paper off. He can't take his own paper off. He's a bit stupid." Her tone suggested that the grown-ups might be not all that bright either for asking unnecessary questions. A few minutes later, Warrender raised a hand and turned away from Colgan to regard Anne and the children in the rear seat, but even the back of his neck and ear were registering his disapproval. "We're nearly there," he said. "You can easily walk the rest of the way to the clearing if you still want to go. But frankly, ma'am, I think this is ill-advised." "Firmly," Colgan said, "we have discussed what we would do in these circumstances a great many times, and we still want to go." As the other began to get out of the car, he added, "Alone." Anne did not reply, and the mouths of the children were otherwise occupied. Warrender closed his door again and rolled down the window so that the antenna of his handset projected beyond the shielding of the car body. He said crisply, "Check their lapel mics and earpaces. Check recorders. Hold the floodlights until they request it. They're leaving the car now." There was enough light filtering through the branches and from the clearing 50 yards ahead to show the track clearly enough for them not to stumble. As they moved slowly forward in line abreast and holding the hands of the children between them, Colgan tried very hard to remember the first time something like this had happened to him. Instead of the dusk and chill of a temperate zone mountain valley, that hillside had been covered by a bright green jungle steaming under the near vertical equatorial sun. His parents, who had recently completed a spell of duty in a New Guinea hospital and anxious to see a little more of the country than the neatly barbered hospital grounds, had accepted an invitation for the whole family to spend 2 weeks on a trip up country. The young couple who had extended the invitation were responsible for the preliminary research and planning of a TV natural history program and wanted congenial company of their own age, as well as assistance with driving one of the 2 station wagons carrying their equipment and camping gear. The accident had happened above a nameless village hugging the lower slopes of the Owen Stanley Mountains. The Colgans had been in the leading car when some native children ran suddenly across the wet, muddy road, causing his father to brake, swerve, and lose control. Their car had ended up on its side, facing back the way it had come, forcing the vehicle following closely behind them to drive around rather than crash into them. But the road on that side fell away sharply into the narrow river valley containing the village. The other car skidded, went over the edge, rolled to the bottom of the slope, and ended upside down in the river. In spite of being more than a foot deep in water, it had exploded and burned, killing the TV people and scattering wreckage and blazing fuel from their reserve tanks over a large area of the village. When the Colgans had climbed out of the car's sunroof, badly shaken but unhurt, they saw that several of the grass and mud shelters were on fire, and there was a lot of confusion, shouting, and children crying. They did not see any casualties, but a growing crowd of villagers was encircling the toppled car, shaking fists or spears and screaming at them. The natives were in an ugly mood, his father had told Colgan later, and at the time he had been uncomfortably aware of the fact that a generation earlier these people had been headhunters and cannibals. He could see it all in his mind's eye, Colgan thought as they approached the clearing, but he could not be sure that it was a true childhood memory or the product of imagination supported by the adult stories heard repeatedly in later life. He simply did not know what had actually happened that day, but he had spent the greater part of his professional life in a vain attempt to find out. The going was much smoother over the last 50 yards because the tanks had turned off into the trees before coming this far, and suddenly they came to a clearing lit in blue-gray monochrome by the late evening sky. "You've stopped, Professor," Warrender's voice whispered in his earpiece. "You're there. Can you see it?" "Yes," said Colgan, wondering where his saliva had gone. "We're moving closer." "Mommy," said Catherine suddenly, "you're holding my hand too tight." Catherine's other hand was holding her baby brother's, who did not like his hand being held by big people, preferring, as now, to hold his father's index finger in a tiny, tightly clenched fist. Walking abreast and holding hands, they moved farther into the clearing. "Is it an airplane?" asked Catherine. "A sort of airplane," said Anne. Even in the dim light, she looked pale. "A sort of spaceship," Colgan thought, with a feeling of great fear and even greater wonder. Aloud, he said quietly, "Lights. I want to be sure they can see us coming." As the floodlights mounted in the surrounding trees came on and slowly brightened, Colgan wondered why they had not reacted when the lighting was being rigged. Perhaps they already knew that there was nothing harmful to them in the simple lighting circuits, but if they had instruments of telling them that, did they also know of the many tanks and other forms of military frightfulness in the trees all around them, and of the outer cordon of heavily armed surface and air patrols sealing off the area within a 20-mile radius from the news media, and of the ring of missile launchers intending to deal with whatever was there if it made any move that could be construed as hostile? And if they knew all that, they would also know that the amateur photographer who had filmed their ship landing and the four aliens who had appeared briefly outside it before he became too nervous to focus and had run off was in custody along with everyone else to whom he had spoken or shown the photographs. But that was giving the aliens credit for being omniscient, for being some kind of extraterrestrial gods. Colgan was no Stone Age Aborigine whose island had been visited for the first time by a strange vessel containing beings who looked even stranger and who therefore had to be deities. If the truth were known, they were probably as anxious about him as he was about them, and the sooner the fears on both sides were allayed, the better. This was the first known contact with visitors from another technologically advanced and hopefully civilized world. It had to be handled carefully, without misunderstandings, but with minimum risk to the human race. When Colgan's advice, as one of the country's foremost linguists, had been sought regarding possible language structures, and he had seen the photographs of the aliens, he had demanded that they try it his way first. He had been riding his particular hobby horse, considered to be a minor insanity afflicting an otherwise eminent and much respected linguist, across the pages of the professional journals for a great many years, and they had allowed him to put his ridiculous ideas to the test. No great harm could come of it, they had decided, except possibly to Colgan and his family. Naturally, he was worried about the presence of his family, but he was fairly certain that they had nothing to worry about. The presence of a family unit showed trust, he had insisted, and remembering one of his colleagues telling him angrily that there was no fanatic like a quiet, gentle, academic fanatic. His pace slowed, but did not stop. The pace ship was wedge-shaped, a lifting body configuration, according to Warrender, and had no external projections or transparent areas that might have been viewpoints. In spite of the shaky hands holding the camera, the cinefilm left no doubt that the ship had dived steeply and force-landed in the only patch of level ground for many miles around. The brightening floodlights showed additional evidence of that. The treetops at one side of the clearing had been snapped off short, and the ship had left a peculiar landing track on the ground. The technical people were intensely interested in how that track had been made, for the ground had not been torn up by direct contact with the vehicle's underside. Instead, it occupied one end of a long area of flattened grass and underbrush that was more than 20 times the width of the ship itself, some kind of repulsion field or perhaps gravity control had been used during the final seconds of flight to break the ship, and they were almost anxious to find out how it was done. Colgan, as they walked slowly over the compressed vegetation, wanted only to find out if what he had done once could be done again. They stopped about 5 yards from the ship's side, and within a few minutes, a tiny aperture appeared in the area facing them and opened like a metal iris until it was more than 2 yards in diameter. A warm orange light fanned out from the interior, interrupted by the moving shadows of the creatures who were emerging. John mumbled something incomprehensible, and Catherine said, He wants another candy, Mammy. Me too. Later, said Anne in a high, unsteady voice. The first of the 4 aliens, clearly visible now, was stepping onto the crushed grass. The film, taken with a telephoto lens at extreme range, had not done the extraterrestrials justice. They looked much more alien and visually horrifying close up. Their bodies were cone-shaped, covered by oily, frond-like organs, or perhaps clothing, and supported by 4 stubby legs. 4 tentacular arms were mounted equidistantly around the waist, and another 4 tentacles, shorter and more slender and terminating in wet, bulbous swellings that had to be eyes, grew from the apex of the cone. All of the eyes were looking at Colgan as the first alien moved aside to let its companions come out. There was a faint, not unpleasant smell that reminded him of ammonia. He stared anxiously back at the alien for several seconds, and suddenly his mind seemed to be playing tricks on him. For an instant he was seeing not the extraterrestrial, but a naked Papuan hunter, thin, bearded, and with the animal bones in his hair held in place with dried mud. Then the memory overlay faded. At least the alien coming towards him was not clutching a spear. The other extraterrestrials emerged and lined up opposite the humans, the adults facing Anne and himself, and what had to be the large and small children facing Catherine and John, respectively. The one in front of Colgan made a few deep, gobbling, incomprehensible sounds, then stopped. The larger and smaller children, in a higher register, followed suit. Suddenly, John let go of his sister's and father's hands. He began waving his arms about in excitement and making incomprehensible noises of his own. "What?" began Anne. "John says they're saying hello, Mammy," said Catherine. "All of them." Colgan cleared his throat nervously and murmured, "I think it's working." Warrender's term was guarded as he replied, "I don't know, Professor. Sometimes youngsters could let their imaginations run away with them. After all, hello is what one expects strangers to say." Colgan did not reply because the memory overlay was back, hiding the four extraterrestrials behind a picture of the Papuan hunter, his mate, and two young children at the forefront of the crowd of villagers surrounding the overturned car. Colgan saw the two naked, pot-bellied children. One of them was his own age and the other his big sister's. Colgan's father had told him later that he had wanted to play with the other boy. Both sets of parents were too nervous to allow this at first, so they had talked instead. The children had prattled away incomprehensibly to each other, while the tension all around had eased and the crowd became less threatening. It was by sheer accident that they discovered that the older children could understand what their baby brothers were saying to each other and were able to pass it on to the parents. After that, the grown-ups found that they were able to relay messages, very simple messages, via their children. It had been easy then for the elder Colgan to apologize for the fire damage to the village. Nobody had been injured, fortunately, and to get help in righting their car so that they could go back to report to the TV people what had happened. He still could not remember how the one-year-old Colgan had done it. The memories were all secondhand from his parents, but now it no longer mattered. "To Catherine," he said, "ask John to tell them that we are pleased to meet them. Ask if they are having trouble and can we help them in any..." "Tell them our intentions are friendly," Warrender broke in, "so long as theirs are." Impatiently, Colgan said, "If either side's intentions were hostile, we would hardly be facing each other with children present." All four of them left their ship shortly after the landing, but stayed inside when your volunteers came close. So maybe that is normal procedure among star travelers in this kind of situation to demonstrate trust and friendship. And the business of using the very young as translators must also have general application, and we have just now found out about it. "Out of the mouths of babes," said Warrender. "But how does it work?" "I don't know," said Colgan absently. A large part of his attention was on the noises being made by his son and the younger alien. There must be a linguistic mechanism by virtue of which very young minds can impress meaning onto nonsense sounds from whomever they originate. But the ability is gradually lost with age and the acquisition of a disciplined spoken language. You must have noticed with your own children, if there was only a couple of years difference in age, that the older one could frequently understand what the baby wanted better than you or your... Oh, excuse me. I think an answer is coming back. Catherine was frowning in concentration as she said, John says we look funny. Car broke down. Can't fix. Mechanic, fix it now. Go away. The first part of the message was probably an innocent remark by John's counterpart, not by his parents. But the final part, even making all possible allowances for translation, did not appear to be friendly. A mechanic, said Warrender excitedly. That's probably the closest your kids can come to saying the ship's engineer. We have to talk to him. It. Damn it, think of all the things it could tell us about. The request was passed to Catherine, who gave it, greatly simplified, to John. Gently, Colgan suggested to Warrender that even if the alien engineer was willing to give such information to the Earth natives, the secret of interstellar flight and their other technological marvels would be of little use after being filtered through the mind and limited vocabulary of a one-year-old interpreter. But John wasn't doing too badly. Mechanic can't come out to talk, Catherine translated, and translated for Warrender's benefit. But why do they want us to go away? After all, they were communicating, albeit in a limited fashion. It was the first time in recorded history that any such contact had been made between the human race and an off-planet intelligent species. Colgan was deeply hurt and bitterly disappointed that the aliens wanted to break off so quickly. Perhaps they considered the humans too unintelligent to waste time over. Catherine had passed on the question without being asked. This time it seemed to be causing great agitation as the goblins moved up and down the line between the young and adult aliens. Their tentacles threshed around, sometimes pointing back at the ship or towards the sky. The oily frondlock growths covering the conical bodies were twitching, proving that they were not clothing after all, and even John was being bothered by something. When he turned to his sister, he seemed ready to cry, and while Catherine was speaking, she did not sound very happy either. He wants to stay and play with his funny friend, she translated. But they said bye-bye, all fixed now. Maybe not fixed, maybe a big bang. Go away, please. Warrender did not need a further translation. He said, I wanted to know a lot more about these people, damn it. And now they're taking off with what sounds like a jury-rigged power plant, which just might go bang. And they don't want us to be caught in the explosion. But how big an explosion? The size of a car bomb? A megaton nuclear device? I don't suppose your boy could... Without waiting for a reply, he went on, No, of course not. A big bang is difficult to quantify for a child. Return to the car at once, Professor. We're getting out of here. Colgan hesitated as he turned away. The only sound was the quiet, urgent voice of Warrender in his earpiece as he ordered the tanks to pull out, the remote camera to be put on automatic, and the air surveillance to be maintained. When the alien ship went up, in either sense of the word, he wanted it recorded. The extraterrestrials were shepherding their young ahead of them into the ship. He put his hand on Catherine's shoulder. "Tell them good luck," he said. This time the reply was simple enough for John to handle his own translation. Screwing up his face with the effort, he enunciated carefully, "Hank Oo." "Thank you, that's very good, John," said Anne. There were more alien goblins being directed at him, but she grabbed both children by the arms and hustled them away before Catherine could translate. The possible catastrophic malfunction did not occur, and the ship took off shortly after they reached the mountain highway. It was only then that Colgan remembered to ask Catherine to repeat the final message. She was kneeling at the rear window, watching the big shooting star that was going up instead of falling down. Without turning, she said, "Thank you, friend. We'll come again." We continue with a story from the January 1987 issue of the magazine of fantasy and science fiction. This is The Man Who Wrote Shakespeare by E. Bertrand Laurie. They were, of course, a few misguided people who criticized the choice of Professor Ace Mongoose as our first ambassador to our ancestors, arguing that it would have been more appropriate to choose a historian, or at the very worst, the inventor of the time machine, Professor Gulnitz, a mere scientist. But consider, who was better qualified? Ace Mongoose was one of the five live-sponsored professors at our great megaloversity of South Central California. His course in prestige fashions, English literature, and gracious living had the highest student attention rating and student buying response rating in the entire country. Besides that, he held three separate PhDs and even the much envied degree of administrator of philosophy, and he had almost finished his thesis for the highest degree of all, administrator of administration. Finally, the title of his thesis, "Did Who Really Write Shakespeare?" made his selection a certainty. On the day of his departure, the vast Jane Fonda Memorial Auditorium was crammed, for every faculty member, every qualified student, uncounted people from the media, the famous varsity rock orchestra, and even a few oddballs from the physics department were there to watch him disappear and, as promised, reappear exactly half an hour later. After the reverent silence during the first commercial, the screens announced Professor Mongoose, and the orchestra stuck up the theme song written especially for the occasion. "He's gonna nippy-tuck this Shakespeare cat. Yay, yay, hey diddly-squat." The time machine itself, an impressive cage-like arrangement of bus bars, gleaming angular bronze helices, and miscellaneous mysterious parts, sat there in mid-stage, buzzing and giving off occasional frightening static discharges. These were not part of Professor Gulnitz's original design, which was much cruder, but had been added by the school's PR and advertising department, the most progressive in the country. As he approached it, despite his shortness of stature, Ace Mongoose was indeed an awe-inspiring figure. Researchers in the PR and ad department had garbed him in a costume they averred was de rigueur for the reign of Elizabeth I. Slashed doublet and hose, a cleverly magnified codpiece, shiny leather jack boots with high heels, and a romantic plume-bedecked hat over a long black curly wig. At his side, he wore a piratical cutlass, and in his right hand, he carried an ancient copy of Shakespeare's complete works, published by something called the Oxford University Press. To achieve even greater verisimilitude, he had been cleverly made up to look as much like Shakespeare as possible. He was greeted by tremendous applause, punctuated by enthusiastic wolf whistles at the spectacle of his codpiece, which lasted through to the second commercial. When it was over, the president of the Megaloversity himself, together with the governor of the state and a miscellany of political and academic dignitaries, stepped forward to introduce him, praise his accomplishments, and congratulate the PR and ad department on the splendid job it had done. Excitement rose, so much so that a few students actually failed to keep the obligatory silence during an especially effective UID commercial. Then Professor Mungoose spoke. "It has been discovered," he began, sensibly neglecting to mention Professor Gulnitz, who was standing quietly at the machine's switches, "that what we have always believed to be the superstitions and meaningless practices of medieval magic were nothing of the sort." He paused, while the media hastily whispered notes into their quarters. "No, indeed. We now know, beyond any doubt, that these practices were simply survivals of an ancient science used by men almost as advanced as we ourselves, to travel backward and forward in the past and future. That was the purpose of all the incantations, the paraphernalia, the ritual, pentacles, tapers, incense. The poor, benighted people of past centuries thought that by employing these, they could conjure demons. Not at all. All they were doing was creating a nexus of force." The screens over his head spelled out N-E-X-U-S and defined it. A nexus on which the operator of a time machine could focus so that it would receive the traveler. And that, my dear friends, is what we are going to do here today as soon as I explain my exciting destination and objective to you. First, for centuries there has been controversy among the learned as to whether the man known as William Shakespeare actually wrote the plays and poems attributed to him. Some have said Sir Francis Bacon wrote them. Others credit Edward de Vere, Earl of Oxford. A few are for Queen Elizabeth herself, and so on. My own, much more logical theory is that while Shakespeare undoubtedly did have a hand in it, he was primarily an administrator, a function far more worthy of his undoubted talents than being a common scribbler. Well, we know of a very busy self-declared magician, a contemporary of Shakespeare's. We know exactly where he lived, and our machine is even now tuned to a moment when he is doing his best to conjure a demon. Again, the screen over his head came to life. "This," said Professor Mungoose, "is what the British Dictionary of National Biography says about him. I'm afraid it is much too long for you to read yourselves, but he called himself a professor of the mathematics and student in physic in Cow Lane, London. And we know that he translated a book on the medicinal uses of opium, edited astrological almanacs, and styled himself M.M., or Master of Medicine. It states that he was a notorious character in London, and that he was mentioned by several playwrights of the time, Ben Jonson, Thomas Middleton, and so on. For our purposes, all that's important is that we know where his house stood in Cow Lane. And that," he broke off dramatically, "is to be my destination on this history-making trip. I have been informed by our scientific associate here that the date of my arrival can only be approximated, but I'm sure it'll be close enough to AD 1600 so that for our practical purposes, it will not matter. After all, in exactly half an hour, I'll be snapped back to our own time. Professor Mungoose's live-in girlfriend, Janny Parboil, was urged forward. She kissed him passionately, expressed her perfect faith in him, and, to the delight of the assembled multitude, tickled his codpiece delicately. Professor Mungoose stepped into the cage, seated himself on the straight chair it contained, waved airily. Professor Gulnitz touched a switch. There was a splash of blue electric flame, a mysterious glow that spread eerily and died. And Professor Ace Mungoose had disappeared. His audience settled back to watch the interim entertainment provided by the screens and to await his return. They waited a half hour, an hour, Professor Gulnitz pulling and pushing his switches frantically. Another hour went by, and grumbling to each other, they left the auditorium. The time machine remained unoccupied. Early in the evening of a too warm June night in 1588, in the house he and his wife had only recently occupied in Cow Lane, Thomas Bretnor was making his first great effort to summon the powers of darkness. The attic room of the narrow three-story house was lighted by several tapers, all compounded of black wax. Five of these surrounded the large pentacle drawn upon the deal floor. A nearby brazier emitted an assortment of stinks, including sulfur, brimstone, a variety of virulent herbs, and whatever else his grimoire called for. A tall, dark cabinet bore what was obviously a dead man's skull, and there were all sorts of raven's wings and miscellaneous bones scattered round. Bretnor himself was a tall, thin young man with rather a high forehead, a fair complexion, a thin, assertive nose, and intense gray eyes. Dressed in a gown appropriately decorated with astrological and cabalistic symbols, he was pacing slowly up and down, intoning the most impressive words, most of them ending in Oth, Ael, and such like sounds of power. Occasionally, he would pause to make mystic gestures over his pentacle and brazier. The room was hot and humid and full of smokes and stenches, and to tell the truth, he was getting a wee bit tired when, on a sudden, the brazier flared up and an abrupt wind blew, hissing and bearing an especially noxious stink. Bretnor stopped still. He stared. There, looking somewhat dazed, was Professor Mungoose. Having been projected seating and having arrived in the same position, he was now sprawled very untidily inside the pentacle. "God's wounds," muttered Bretnor to himself. "I've trapped one." He backed to the attic door, opened it, pointed his finger at his quarry. "Move not, foul friend," he ordered. Then over his shoulder, "Elizabeth," he shouted to his wife. "Good Bess, come a-running. I have succeeded. I've caught a demon. Not merry much of one, I fear, but at least I have him fast." "Good day to you, noble sir," sputtered Professor Mungoose, struggling to sit up and to free the cutlass entangled in his legs. The impact of the scene, of the assorted stenches, the smoke, the heat, and his own disarray had been almost too much for him. "I greet you, famed Thomas Bretnor." Here Elizabeth entered, having come a-running as she had been bidden to. She took one look at the professor, wrinkled her nose, and said, "Well, it's a pretty beauty, isn't it? Why, it doesn't even have a tail. Oh, I dare say it does, replied her husband. Perhaps it's tucked up into that great codpiece it's wearing. She giggled, and Thomas Bretnor suddenly thought of her between the sheets and realized what a trim, pretty little thing she was. But he said severely, Nay, do not judge it as you might a fellow man, my girl. 'Tis dangerous, for Satan and his fiends are sly indeed, and any shape they take, you may be certain, is taken to deceive. Professor Mungoose pushed himself first to all fours, then with an effort to his feet. Kind sir, he pleaded, I'm afraid I have a cramp. May I sit in that chair you have there? Ha! Replied his captor. What did I tell you, Bess? Already he's trying to trick its way out of the pentacle. Well, fiend, thou shalt not succeed. Dost take me for a simple peasant conjurer? There, I have you, and there you shall remain. The professor reminded himself of the 400-year cultural and scientific advantage over even the greatest of Elizabethans. He gathered his faculties and forced himself to assume an attitude of urbane superiority. My dear fellow, he declared, if you think you have evoked a devil, you are indeed a simple rustic. I am no fiend, no indeed. I am a traveler through time, come here from the distant future, more than 4 centuries after the reign of your good queen. It speaks English, exclaimed Bess. But how strangely, Tom, could it be a foreign demon? Methinks it hath a Spanish look about it. Of course it speaks strangely, agreed her husband. But that is simply because English is not the native tongue of hell. Well, we shall listen to its prattle for a moment before we continue on the business I fetched it for. Speak on, fiend. Professor Mungoose described the world he came from, the institution where he was held in such high esteem, and the mechanism that had brought him. As they remained quiet, he smiled at them, and started for the chair himself. He started, and he advanced, exactly 18 inches, something invisible but unyielding and impenetrable barred his way. What the devil? He snapped involuntarily. Thomas Bretnor laughed aloud, slapping his knee and embracing his best gleefully. Fiend! There'll be no help from that source for you. Nothing can break through the spells I have erected here. Think again. I brought you here for a purpose, as I'm sure you know. And till that purpose is achieved, till you have brought me gifts of lore and learning, of power or riches, and not until then shall I release you to rejoin your satanic master. Apprehensively, Professor Mungoose tried the barrier once again. It held. Suddenly, he was nervous. Could there have been more to necromancy than merely providing shuttle service for time travelers? He shook off the idea, comforting himself with the thought that now, in less than half an hour, he would be snapped safely back to the stage of the Fonda Memorial Auditorium. I am no fiend, he declared, striving to put sincerity into his voice. I really am no fiend, and I can give you neither the learning of a Faustius, the power of a Tamerlane, nor riches. Neither diamonds, emeralds, rubies, pearls, nor gold have I. I am here on a much grander mission. Do you see this book? Aye, Bretnor replied, I do see it. And doth it contain secrets that give power over earth, air, fire, and water? Doth it tell of the philosopher's stone or the universal solvent? Nothing so crass, answered Professor Mungoose. The heat was getting to him and he was sweating. This book contains the great works of your companion, William Shakespeare. Bretnor looked at his wife and she at him. Shakespeare? She echoed. William Shakespeare? Why, I know one only of the name, a youth only recently up from Stratford, well-bred and amiable enough and lusting to become an actor. Remember, love? We met him at the theater. But zounds, he is no playwright, not he. Professor Mungus began to sweat even more profusely. What year is this? He stammered. Why, were you not a beastly demon, you'd know well enough, Bretnor told him. 'Tis the year of our Lord 1588, exactly and precisely. Good God! Blaspheme not, fiend. Professor Mungus did not even hear him, virtually felled by the realization that he had arrived 2 years before Shakespeare had written anything. He could not even curse himself for being ignored Professor Gullnitz's warnings of the time machine's imprecision. He was gasping like a fish out of water. And that wretched book is all that you brought with you? Bretnor demanded. Yes, all. Then give it here, that I may judge it. Professor Mungus told himself that each moment now was precious, and that he was buying the seconds, the long minutes before his rescue. Bretnor, in a deep voice, uttered a strong protective spell, stepped up to the pentacle, took the blue volume from a trembling hand. He walked over to the chair, sat down. Bess came and looked over his shoulder. He leafed through the book. Well, well, he said, the comedy of errors, A Midsummer Night's Dream, the tragedy of Hamlet, Prince of Denmark. All that sounds well enough. Let's see. He began to read at random. To be or not to be, that is the question. Whether it is better in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or to take arms against a sea of troubles and by opposing end them, to die, to sleep, and by a sleep to say we end the heartache and the thousand natural shocks that flesh is heir to. Not bad. Not bad at all, he committed. Perchance this book is not as worthless as at first 'twould seem. At this point, Professor Mungus decided that he might strengthen his own case by exhibiting a familiarity with the great poetry of the bard, and he started to quote Macbeth at Macbeth's bloodiest. Oh, I like that knot, Bess cried. Tom, cannot we not be rid of this abominable small creature? Can you not expel it from our house? Of course I can, declared her husband, handing her the book, and it's high time I did. He stood, took up his grimoire, opened it, read aloud a spell so awful that even though he understood not a word, Professor Mungus trembled in his soul. Please, no, he shrieked. Thou shalt not cozen me, fiend, answered Bretnor, opening a packet of mysterious substances taken from beside the skull and holding it above the brazier. Now I shall summon those powers who shall return you to your master. And aloud, as he emptied the packet into the coals, he called out several vast and terrible names. Instantly there was flame. Instantly there was smoke. Professor Mungus screamed just once as it enveloped him, and Bess told Thomas afterwards that she had seen great black clawed hands seizing him. Then, just as suddenly, the smoke cleared. The pentacle was empty. Thomas Bretnor shrugged. Well, he said, we managed that very nicely, didn't we? I must say, Bess, that you were very brave. If I weren't, she smiled, dear Tom, I never would have married you. But, she shuddered, Tom, must we have these stinks? Could we not open up a little window? Of course, he answered and did so, "And now," he said, "can you busy yourself with other tasks? I fain would be left to read this book. I have the feeling that that foolish demon may unwittingly have presented us with something much worse the having." For 2 hours, Thomas Bretnor read an excerpt here, an excerpt there, familiarizing himself with the strange type, the unaccustomed punctuation. Finally, he joined Bess downstairs. "We very surely do have something here, dear Bess," he told her. "Of course, these plays are not something I can offer as my own. It would be very damaging to my profession. But that young man you mentioned, the one with the same name, I can copy the plays out one by one, with a few changes and improvements, to be sure, and it'll be to our mutual profit for him to offer them under his name and to keep a close mouth as to their origin. So let us send a message for him to wait upon us, say, 3 days from now. In the meantime," he smiled at her, "there's an hour like the present to begin. So dost thou fetch me paper and inkpot and a good goose quill." She brought them forthwith. Then, pen in hand, the book before him at the table, Thomas Bretnor sat down to write Shakespeare. This is Laura Waterman, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading science fiction.